Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this evening. We are going to tackle a number of topics over the next couple of hours. We're going to start by talking with Dr. Tabet Abdullah, who's joined us many times, a professor of history at York University, who is a leading expert on the Middle East and what's going on. And every day this thing is exploding. We look, the connections are deep. We start with the connections at the top of this 5 o'clock hour and end our show at 6:30 with the other connection here, which is Madison and the Middle East, both feeding off one another in some very interesting ways. I heard a story which we'll talk about in the 6 o'clock hour, which is unions in Cairo are sending money to Madison to buy pizzas for the demonstrators in Madison. So the connections do exist. Dr. Tabet Abdullah, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much. Good to be there.
So, Tabet, let's just start with I remember when we wrote an email back and forth with one another when I was about to say Nasser, when Mubarak left Cairo and went to his home in Sharm el-Sheikh, and the demonstrators pushed him out with the help of the army who took over the country. And you were elated then and kind of really weren't prepared to talk, because like many people were just excited by that moment. But in the clear light of day, with time that has passed since he left, and some people look at the army consolidating power, others see the demonstrators fighting for democracy as gaining power. I would like to hear analysis where you think it lives right now.
The clear light of day is a really dangerous place to go to.
Sometimes it is.
Yes. No, I'm still very, very happy at what took place. It is something that was coming for a long time now. Some of the structural problems in the Arab world could not have withstood this kind of imposed authoritarianism much more. But obviously, as with any major revolution, there are all kinds of dangers, and it's always a very messy process before a new order is built. Remember, say the French Revolution, for example, went through numerous trials and tribulations before some kind of stability emerged, including the rise of a new monarchy, actually, at one point. And the same with the Bolsheviks, and the same with others. One of the things that is rather impressive about the Egyptian case in particular is that the leadership has very consciously laid out a very conservative program. And I mean that word in a very precise way.
Mm-hmm.
It is very careful not to push for idealistic gains. So this is encouraging. But already, of course, after the dust sort of just barely settled on Tahrir Square, new struggles have flared up, whereby the leadership of the uprising are organizing themselves more tightly, which is something that was needed. They are extremely weary of where the military is going. Don't forget that the single most important target of all of these uprisings in the Arab world is crony capitalism. It is the notion or the structure in which a small family or a small ruling oligarchy rewards a group of corrupt entrepreneurs and buys loyalty from
mm-hmm.
them. This is what the main target of these uprisings are. And the military, the Egyptian military, including especially its top brass, is very much part and parcel of this disease of crony capitalism. So it is going to resist. Yet the dynamics of this is that the military is weary of the secret police and has formed an alliance with the mass movement in trying to clip the wings of the secret police. In order to do so, it needs to give certain concessions. The most important of these concessions is to trim back crony capitalism, and we'll see how far that will go.
What about the issue of a truly democratic election coming up? Do you think that will take place?
What is truly democratic?
I don't know what that means either, really.
Yeah, anybody that's
what does that mean?
Especially after the debacle in Florida in one of your elections down there. But I think it will be more free.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are the Democratic movement will make. And I think this is essentially what they're shooting for. But in terms of an untainted, completely clean election, which will express the exact will of the people of Egypt, I don't think that is just a matter of setting up the right system. I think it's a matter of long-term education, a certain sense of activism, the development of strong non-governmental organizations that can mobilize voters around important causes, etc. So that will still be a way down. But the important thing here, in my opinion, is that any gain that is made is one that will create a better condition for future struggles. So in this sense, it is very positive and is a cause for rejoicing.
It is as if a motion, political and social motion, is moving forward that is almost irresistible, even though it meets the force of an army that helped liberate it, but at the same time is part and parcel, as you said, of that kind of whole corporate corrupt world in Egypt. But it's happening all over. I mean, this is Egypt. Something's being unleashed in the Arab world right now.
Well, you know, just a quick thing about the Egyptian army before I talk about the horror that is taking place in Libya now.
Yes, I want to go there next, yes.
Yeah, but the Egyptian army, one of the things that is on the side of the democratic forces there is that the Egyptian army has never fired on the Egyptian people. Since its formation in the early 19th century, it has always been employed in defense of the borders or in foreign adventures. It has invaded Greece. It has gone into Saudi Arabia, which would be wonderful if that occurs again. It has gone into many battles against Israel, of course. But it has never been an army like other third world countries, which has conquered its own country.
Hmm.
Say, for example, the Iranian army, the chief reason that it was formed in the early 20th century was essentially to conquer the country itself, to conquer Iran itself from various separatists and leftist groups. The same with the Iraqi army. It was essentially a nation-forming institution, not so with the Egyptian army. That has never occurred. So it is extremely difficult for even these corrupt generals to go against this kind of long tradition of playing a neutral force, essentially. This is something that the mass movement has taken full advantage of. This is not the case, of course, with Libya and their tribalism. You see, in many ways, actually, these uprisings all over the Arab world remind one of the history that we read about 1848 in Europe.
The revolutions in Europe took place in Paris and Berlin.
The 1848 revolutions, which erupted in France and then in Germany and then in Hungary and all over Europe, it engulfed Europe. In every single country, it had very specific causes. There was a general common feature to it, but each one played out in a very different manner. In some places, they were rebellions against monarchies. In other places, they were nationalist rebellions of independence, etc. So too in the Arab world, there's a general feature to it. But whereas in Egypt, it tended to be, on the whole, rather peaceful, with the army playing a positive role in supporting the mass movement, in Libya, it is quite savage, with very strong tribal undertones, and the response of the European countries has been rather shocking. Also, not so long ago, Gaddafi was seen as the devil incarnate, and after he sort of came back down to earth, sort of speak, and with various contracts worth billions signed, especially with Italy, there's a real reluctance to condemn him. I mean, Berlusconi has been extremely slow in even issuing a position of condemning the use of airplanes and bombing his own people.
What's interesting is that when you look at Al Jazeera today, by the way, we're talking with Dr. Tawhid Abdullah, professor of history at York University, who is an activist in Iraq, had to flee Iraq and has been living in Toronto, and has been a guest on our show many times since the United States first contemplated invading Iraq. You can join us here at 410-319-8888 as we look at the Middle East, latest update with Dr. Tawhid Abdullah. What I was saying, the Al Jazeera today, and there's an article just now, just posted saying, game over, brother Muammar Gaddafi, that his days are numbered, as were Mubarak's. How do you find that to be real?
Well, I don't know. I can't assess the conditions on the ground. But from what I've heard, the second capital of Libya, I mean, Libya is essentially divided into the eastern and the western parts. The western part of Libya looks to Tripoli as being the political center. The eastern part looks to Benghazi. Benghazi has completely fallen in the hands of the rebels. Segments of the army have joined the rebels. Practically all of the major tribes have also declared their support of the uprising. The Gaddafi is still holding on to power through two avenues. One is his own tribe, the Gaddafis, as they're called, which have benefited enormously from his rule through cronyism. The second is through the use of mercenaries, which is an extremely disturbing phenomena, and one which could complicate the whole transformation, because he is bringing in apparently large numbers of mercenaries from various sub-Saharan African countries, including Ghana, for example, and others, and has unleashed them. And he is able to do this because Libya is an extremely rich oil country, and the wealth, the revenues of the oil are firmly in the hands of the central state. So he has the finances to use in this manner, and he also has a history of being quite vicious, very much like Saddam Hussein of Iraq and
who he loved.
Of Syria. Yes, of course.
Yeah. So I'm curious in the larger scheme, as you look at your historical analysis and the way you analyze our political world, what do you think the possibilities are in terms of what the future of North Africa and the Middle East may be? I mean, this is so transformative. And you're not pressuring. I'm not asking you to say what is going to happen. But clearly, I'm interested in your analysis where you think we may be headed.
One of the most malignant features of the modern Middle East is the feeling of hopelessness that had dominated the region. Utter and complete sense of hopelessness and humiliation. These uprisings have overnight transformed this. It is through this overbearing sense of hopelessness that we get the suicide bombers and the Al-Qaedas and 9/11s. These uprisings, should they lead to some form of positive change, I think will result in a great reduction in this truly horrible feature of suicide bombers and nihilism, which had dominated much of the activism of the area. So that's one thing. The other thing is that the reverberations of this have gone well beyond the Middle East. I have read that even in China there are real fears of demonstrations, that there are some rumors of the young techno-savvy aspiring aspiring entrepreneurs of China who are fed up with authoritarianism and cronyism are thinking of organizing along the same lines. So this is a general feature of our time, cronyism and authoritarianism, which has been a real detriment to capitalist development. I mean, these revolutions are not they are not calling for a complete overhaul of the system. Rather, they are calling for a cleaner capitalism, if you will, mm-hmm. or a capitalism free of cronyism. And that is very appealing to wide sectors of the population in various parts of the world.
Let me take a phone call here and have another question for Talbot, then we'll move on to some other issues. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We're talking with Dr. Talbot Abdallah. And Clarence, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mr.
Hi, Clarence.
How are you?
Welcome. Good to have you again.
I'd like to ask a quick question, please. Somewhere down the line, no matter where these movements take these various people in these countries, do you see it somehow as more democratic politics go into these countries? Do you see it somehow down the line coming in direct clash with the Muslim religion, with Islamic religion?
No, I do not see a inherent conflict between the Islamic religion and the greater empowerment of a population. The Islamic religion, just like all religions, has been interpreted in numerous ways and is constantly changing. In the medieval period, for example, under Islamic law, slavery was permitted. In the 19th century, when slavery was seen to be evil, new interpretations of Islam emerged, whereby Islam is now outlawed and is considered to be a great sin against God. Likewise, some interpretation of Islam sees or argues that women should not be full participants in society. This we see in the interpretation that is supported by that horrible family that rules in Saudi Arabia. Whereas other religious scholars have argued that women should be full participants in society and have even said that they would support women leaders in society. So Islam is extremely flexible, like all major religions. There is incredible room for interpretation and reinterpretation of even the most profound pillars of the religion. And I believe that if a society really feels that it is time for democratization, for greater freedoms, it will tend to give rise to interpretations of religion that support that.
Let's try to squeeze another caller in here. Oh, look, she's gone. She was here, but she left. Okay, so I'll ask the question. So I wonder, when you look at also the larger political analysis here, I mean, and how you wrap up what's happening now with the Middle East, with these uprisings throughout nations in the Arab and Muslim world.
So far, it's been Arab, really. The only non-Arab country that has really affected is Iran.
Right.
Yes. But Iran, in many ways, is a real exception. And in some ways, it's the country that sort of started it all, didn't it?
In 79.
In 79, yes.
Right.
Yes.
I wonder how you juxtapose the analysis you have about what's going on within the Arab world with the Western world's reaction, the relationship between the West and oil, and how that continues to play a role in what may change or not change within the Middle East.
Well, look, when the last time I spoke with you, I was very critical of the Western media.
Right.
And I felt that the Obama administration had pretty much played it, you know, rather well. I know that there are others who are more critical of the American administration, but I'm not so sure they could have done more. Don't forget that the Arab world is extremely, and this is to put it mildly, extremely suspicious of anything specifically that the United States and Britain might do. And for reasons that have nothing to do with culture, it is because of the past practices of the United States and Britain in the region, in terms of the Cold War, their support of dictators in the region, turning a blind eye to the worst forms of exploitation, etc. So because of this, I don't think that the United States, Britain, and other Western countries can do much more. There is some leverage. For example, the Egyptian military has mostly been trained by the United States and is supplied by the United States. So the United States does have some leverage over the military, but it should exercise this with extreme caution. In terms of the oil, there is no doubt that all over the Western world right now there's absolute panic, because nobody really saw this coming. I mean, there were structural problems, and for example, the extremely high level of unemployment. The Arab world has the highest level of youth unemployment anywhere in the world. In terms of the incredible failure of these systems to produce, I mean, the only thing that they're living off of is essentially oil and tourism. The Arab world combined produces, in terms of manufactured production, less than Israel, which is a very tiny country of 5 million. There's been a general even decline in enthusiasm for education. I mean, another little fact I can give you is that all of the books that have been translated into Arabic in the past 20 years combined are still amount to only 1/5 of those that were translated into Greek for use in the tiny country of Greece. Hmm. So there's been an incredible failure of these systems to improve life, to keep up with the pace of development of the rest of the world, and something had to crack, and it has. And the West, while extremely concerned about its interests, specifically oil, knows that there's no way that they can turn this back, absolutely none. So they are, it seems to me, just from reading how the reactions are, that they are trying to position themselves in a way so as not to appear to be against this change, and at the same time try to use its leverage with great caution so that the change does not become too radical, that it can still be friendly or open to Western contacts and Western businesses.
And we'll see where that takes us. Dr. Tabet Abdallah, it is always a pleasure and an honor to have you with us. And I tell our listeners here, I was looking on the web at York University, and the students at York University give you very high marks as a teacher. So congratulations. They say you're a tough tester and a tough grader, but a good teacher.
Life is tough, my friend.
Life is always tough. Life is tough. Fare is only something you pay to get on the bus, as I like to say. So, Tabet, thank you so much once again.
Thank you.
We'll be talking to you again soon. Dr. Tabet Abdallah, professor of history at York University, who was an Iraqi activist who fought against Saddam Hussein, had to flee the country, now lives in Canada with his family, and teaches history at York University. We'll be back with us again soon as we continue our coverage every day of what's happening in the Middle East, as we will do with Wisconsin as well, two things that are changing the nature of our existence, and we have to follow what's going on. We're going to take a very brief break. We're going to talk with one of my favorite people in the city, Dante Wilson, and some others here in our studio. He's a man who knows more about how to handle and talk with families and children in the streets of our inner cities than any person that I know. So he joins us with others in the studio in just a moment. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. More information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Don't go away. We will be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. As you know, we feature a number of people during the course of a month to talk with us about issues that they're deeply concerned about and work with in our communities. And you've heard them, Dr. Lester Spence, Michelle, and many others. And one of those voices you'll hear on a regular basis on this program is Dante Wilson, who got his MSW here at Morgan State University and who I met when we were doing our project, Just Words, The Voices of the Working Poor, and he's the founder and director of Reclaiming Our Children and Community Project in the southwest side of our city. We've remained in touch, and he is on the show today. We're going to be talking about homelessness and children and youth in our communities, something that a lot of you have faced yourself and know that exists very deeply. We're joined by a young man who has worked with Dante in the past, and they have met again, Michael Blackwell. Welcome to the studio. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
And Charisse Lanier is with us, who works with the Chesapeake Center for Youth and Development, and who's also been a caller on this show, and it's lovely to meet you and have you in the studio, Charisse. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And my good friend Dante. Good to have you in the studio, Dante Wilson.
Thank you, Ms. Ma.
So let's talk a bit about this issue. I mean, and folks, I want you to join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. We did a program here several years back on the show when we discovered what we call the Lord of the Flies in our own communities. And the Lord of the Flies, of course, is that great book about young people who were stranded on a desert island and the society they formed. But in our society here in Baltimore and many cities around the country, there are Lord of the Flies communities all over the place, where young people who have no place to go, who are homeless, take over abandoned homes, and live among themselves in their own hierarchical order to survive in the streets. And that's, unfortunately, Dante, not a situation that is rare enough.
Yes, sir. It's really unfortunate, and the numbers and the rates here in Baltimore alone, we're not even considering Maryland as a whole, but here in Baltimore alone, that it's so alarming, and I think that we as society may take it for granted. I was disturbed about 3 weeks ago. I spoke to a young man who was in a group home. He was released from the group home. DSS gave his aunt 6 months of money for him to live with her, and within 2 months, she kicked him out. So he's just living on the street, and I recall because I rode down North Avenue and I saw the young man, and he just looked like he was lost. And I asked, I said, "Where you been at?" You know, and he explained to me the situation, what happened. And so, you know, I infer by our conversation that he's homeless. And so I say, "Did you go to a friend house last night?" He say, "Nah, Mr. Dante." I say, "What did you do last night?" "I walked the streets." When I woke up that morning, it was ice on my windshield. So it hurt me to my heart because he have to walk and be in this physical cold, and I don't know what impact that it may have on him. Then, of course, you know, hygiene and things of those natures. And so I was able to get the young brother, and I took him to one of the Cold Blue downtown shelters. And he was able to be seen, and we set it up where he would see a caseworker in the morning, because he did receive some social services such as food stamps, but the aunt that he was supposed to be living with, she was receiving those things. So we was trying to get him back on base, but I haven't even been able to catch up with him, and it's understandable.
Because he's in the street.
He's in the street.
Now, how old is this kid?
He was 19.
19. A teenager still.
Yes, sir.
A teenager still. So I and Michael Blackwell, you had a story that Dante was talking about when we came in, that you experienced some of this yourself.
Yeah, me and my mother just recently had a confrontation for real. I'm just getting older now, and I was just taking her for granted, and she put me out.
And what did you do?
I went to a friend house, stayed with my girlfriend for a few days. But it's nothing like your own, though. Like, when you out there, you just thinking, like, I got a very sick mother, so her trying to distance herself away from me was even hurting me even more. It's just tough for real for young people because, like, all of us don't have the things in life that we need as far as, like, high school diplomas or just...
Do you have one?
I'm getting mine.
Yeah, good.
High school diplomas, a house just to lay your head at night. Like, it's nothing like your own. And some people living arrangements are hard to live with when you go to that house because you don't know what you're going in. You don't know what you're getting yourself into. You don't know if somebody's getting high in there or... They got a lot of kids around, or, like, it could be deaf in the room. And they might not want to change their room around and make that person sleep in there. You feel me? You touch anything and start to bicker and stuff like that. It's hard out here for us young people, especially young black men. Like, we go through a lot. Like, it's hard for us to find jobs, everything. Like, we just don't have a lot to turn to, especially when you don't got a lot of family in your corner. Like, that's why I really appreciate Mr. Dante. Like, I just ran back into him last week for a long time. And for some reason, like, I just felt blessed for real, because he a real positive person. Like, he'll help anybody. Anybody, like. And I've been through it. Like, we done had a funeral in the center for my best friend, just so he can have somewhere to lay his head at before he go. Like, we ain't had to pay for nothing. Like, and after that, I just took him, like, he almost like a father figure. So I knew I can, like, I felt like things was going good at that scene, to be honest. And after that, I'm just talking things out about things now. Like, how can I get my living arrangements back right?
You're back home now.
Oh, I'm back home for now.
For now. For now. Well, Sharice, talk a bit about your connection with all this and what you've seen.
Well, I actually work with Dante Wilson, and I'm very impressed by his passion for working with our youth, inner-city youth, and youth abroad. What I'm learning about being in the nonprofit sector is that there are a wealth of resources for underprivileged families, mainly youth as well. And I feel that there should be some type of centralized, you know, location for information for young people. I mean, you know, the young people know how to use the internet these days. So, and they are, you know, comfortable with going to libraries just so they can use the internet to check Facebook, et cetera. But, you know, if they knew that there was also somewhere where they could go to get help on their own without having to have a parent or a guardian with them to apply for social services, like if there was just some type of walk-in facility or maybe a website they could go to find resources, because the resources are out here. And these kids are, most of the kids that I meet who are in these type of situations, they are very self-sufficient. Some of them do exemplify some apathy. But again, that's just because they haven't had the guidance that they really need, nor do they have the motivation or the confidence to maybe pursue certain things. But I think when you are forced to fend for yourself, if you know where the resources are, I think you will become just that more self-sufficient and resourceful, because they are typically used to struggling and used to providing for themselves. But they pick and choose where they want help. They rather try to find money to buy the latest fashions rather than trying to figure out how to get, you know, public assistance and help themselves.
I mean, how deep do you think the problem is? And folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. I want you to think about your neighborhoods, about people around you, about people you see, about people you know, perhaps school teachers as well, about the numbers of children in our communities who are homeless and what we need to do to deal with that, because it has to do with where they can go to school and what whether they attend school or not, and how they live and where they live and what it's actually doing to this rising population of homeless young people. 26% of all people using our shelters are people who are under the age of 18. And many of those people are in the counties, not just the city. Dante?
I think the concern in the topic is very prevalent. Especially in the inner city, you have a lot of young people that are living in abandoned houses. You have a lot of teachers, in my humble opinion, who understand what's going on when young people come to the school, and middle school and high school students that are tired. They sleep from one house to the next house. And when you ask them where do they live, they may say with an aunt. And then you ask them the following week, they may say with a godmother. But based on the relationship of that particular caretaker who's involved in that person's life, we should infer that they don't have a primary place of residence. So that they technically is homeless. And so this is a big concern, you know. It's a big concern with those people, that transitional age of 16 to 21, who are leaving group homes and leaving independent living programs because they didn't continue with their education. Now that they reach the age of 18 years of age, now that the system said, okay, you have to fend for yourself. But the reality is we haven't prepared these young people. And even though we may consider them young adults, but they really young people, the mindset is very immature. They are not prepared to deal with the daily responsibilities as adults. And so what happens is you see you see these young people, and the young person that I'm thinking of right now, when you drive down North Avenue, you will see him in front of the pawn shop morning, noon, and night because he's homeless.
I'm going to open the phone to it. One of the things, and so Taylor and Theodora, we're going to come right to your calls here. I just want to raise this one issue with Dante as you raise this. I mean, I think it's interesting because a lot of kids, young people in the inner cities who are homeless, semi-homeless, on the streets a lot, there is a seeming maturity because they have to figure out how to survive. But because of the way they've lived their lives, mm-hmm. there's a deep immaturity in terms of their values, understanding of how the world really works mm-hmm. and what to do with their own lives.
Absolutely.
There's this contradiction that exists with these young people.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, Dante and I work for two nonprofit organizations that specialize in providing the resources and services for these at-risk kids. But with my nonprofit, more so, we work with kids transitioning back into the communities. So, you know, again, it's sad to say that you would have to acquire the resources. You would have to be detained before you can acquire the resources. You know, I'm actually trying to work with Dante now, trying to figure how can we establish a more, something more concrete. So before the kid becomes an offender, you know, what is in place for them if they're not in juvenile services? You know, is there a number they can call? A lot of these kids are living in the household with, you know, parents who are addicted to drugs. So the kids are just, you know, being neglected. You know, so a lot of times they'll leave the house on their own because of the drama in their own home. And then that's when they become homeless because they never want to go back. And because there's no parent figure in that household with a sane and clear mind to say, hey, where's my child? You know? You know what I mean? And then they have these big families, and so the kid's at aunt's house, and the kid is crashing wherever, and it's just allowable. And so they offend, and they go through DJS, and then they have these court dispositions to be enrolled into these, you know, services, so, you know, to lower the recidivism rates, and essentially that's supposed to be the solution so they won't reoffend. But when it doesn't work out like that, then what? And then I think that's why we're here having this conversation.
Let me open the phone so I'll have folks join us in this conversation. 410-319-8880. It's Charisse Lanier, Austin City's Michael Blackwell, and Dante Wilson, Director of Reclaiming Our Children and Community Project. 410-319-8888. First we go to Taylor, then Theodora. Taylor, on the west side, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. One of the things that I want to say is that I work in a group home. Mm-hmm. A lot of times these young men have an opportunity to get an independent living program. A lot of these young men don't want to listen to discipline. They don't want to discipline themselves to go to school. We try to train them because it's mostly men that are in the house training young men and trying to prepare them for society. They don't want to listen. Then when they get 18 or 19 years old, when their time is up, then they're lost because they're not willing to discipline themselves. And all through the system has pushed them through. Then when they get to a place that's a good program, and they don't have the necessary guidance or the discipline themselves, then they're lost. That's what young man possibly has not been able to succeed in life because probably when he got to where he was at in reference to his relative or his aunt or whoever, wasn't able to discipline himself to listen. And a lot of them don't want to discipline themselves to listen to follow a direct request. It's not an order, but it's a request for when you're supposed to do certain things, you need to be able to follow that request or that demand or whatever. And that's the reason why a lot of them are homeless, because they're not willing to listen, because they haven't listened before. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Taylor, for your thoughts. Let me go to Dante. We'll go all around the room. Start with Dante, and then we'll come over to both Charisse.
I agree very little with the gentleman. I write proposals.
You agree little?
Little.
Little.
I write proposals for group homes. I train staff at group homes. And what I see a lot of time with the adults in group homes is that there is a disconnect. Yes, the young person is in our services for a particular reason. They're there for that reason, whether it was neglect, whether it was whatever the situation might have been that got them into our particular group home. However, what I see in the climate and culture of group home staff is that it's not conducive to help modify the behavior of these young people. And so we have a young person that comes in, and when we develop, if we develop relationship, because everything is based on relationship. But when you have a young person who has no roots and direction, and you bring them into a group home where staff, every shift structure. Is not consistent with the structure to create the climate and culture that is conducive for the young people, what ends up happening, these group homes and these independent living programs actually become babysitting institutions, allowing them to break curfew and do a multiple other things. And then when it comes time for 18, because even though they're 18, by law, they don't have to be discharged from the group home. It's, if they enrolled in work and if they enrolled in a college course or something of that nature to further their education, they really could go up to 21. But when there's nothing that the person is doing active, then, you know, we have to stop the services. And now they have to be exposed to that life out there, which they often end up in homelessness. And so I'm not 100% blaming the young person for that condition, but I also feel as though some, not all, I don't want to be quoted by saying all, but a lot of these group home institutions cause or contribute to the fact that a person is homeless.
Now, I'm going to let the other guests kind of chime in here, but I give another call, but I'm going to come back and hear what you have to say, Dante, about what makes a group home work.
Okay.
This is really important. That's but, right. Michael, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I wanted to say, I agree on what the guy's saying, too, but all negative actions don't come out from just us being negative. Like, some people don't even have positive people in their life. And, like, for people just to say that when we turn 19 and 18 and all that we're just ready to go through barriers in our life, it doesn't happen straight like that. Like, barriers are brought on to us. Like, you don't know what was going on into the household. You don't know how that person was living or how he was living off other people. That's a lot of things out here. Like, and a lot of us need good, positive people in our life. How would somebody feel if 30 people come up to you telling you different stuff every day? One day you can someone say, forget it, and you start listening to yourself. You know, a lot of people don't be wanting a lot of help because everybody want to be positive before they turn negative. And you got to be negative sometimes and go back to be positive to see how life outcomes things. And some people just don't understand that. Some people don't even have kids, and they try to judge on people. Like, you just can't judge nobody these days, especially not no young fella. Especially not me. I'm not going to have anyone judge me, and that's just me. Like, I'm going to speak out on things, and I feel as though, like, the person that you spoke, I'm not going to get into it.
Shreeza, did you want to add to this when we come back to?
Yes, I think the caller made a great point. A lot of our youths, particularly the men as well as the women, you know, overall they lack the discipline. And again, their values are skewed. Dante and I talk about this often, the importance of restructuring the cognitive behavioral condition, which means it's just changing the mindset. You know, how... You know, if we're here to empower the children, but if they're not receptive to what we're doing, if they can't understand that, regardless of their past, the point is if the help is put in front of them, then it's up to them to take advantage of it. And if they're being resistant because they're lacking discipline or they think they're too cool for it or they don't need it, then that's when, you know, you have this epidemic. So... I think the main thing is transforming the mindset, and we're trying to implement services and programs that will do that. But again, it's more reactive versus proactive. And again, I'm new to the whole nonprofit sector, and so and in the field of social work. But you know, my passion is here, and you know, I'm trying to learn along with my colleagues. Is you know, what can we do to proactively meet the kids where they are, if you will.
Mm-hmm. So what works? I mean, when you had the critique of saying something was almost like warehousing kids was actually just changing behavior, what does that mean? I mean, how does that? What's your model and idea about what works?
What works is having a strategic plan in the beginning. What is the mission and vision of your company? If we want to use the example of group homes, what is it that we're going to teach these young people? Because prior to the young person coming to the group home, you have to interview the young person. So during that interview process, that's when we are laying out the framework in which we're supposed to be teaching this young person new skills. Because the thing is, you have young people that operate within a subculture of what they and their peers create, and that that subculture becomes their main society, but it differs and in conflicts with the society in which they actually supposed to live in. And so the interview process has to be a specific way, and that way the child or the youth, the participant, is contracted on certain guidelines in which they're supposed to go. But then money need to be invested in the training. I understand what a curriculum look like. I understand what a job description say, but you have way too many group homes where young people supposed to be in school, they're not enrolled in school. You have young people who's supposed to be learning money management, especially if you're dealing with that transitional age, because the reality is when they get released, they supposed to be able to fend for themselves. But what we are seeing, based on the stacks, these young people aren't fending for themselves. And so how effective is our financial literacy inside of a group home? What about communication, soft skills, cognitive? That's what the young sister was talking about when we say cognitive restructuring, interpersonal skills on how you're supposed to communicate. What is the level of respect? What is the climate and culture that is promoted inside the house that is so embedded into the young person that when they leave into the community or the schools or wherever it is they may go, that they are reflecting that same type of mentality? But if a young person is leaving a group home, pants still sagging, still talking to e-bonnets, still doing all the negative and deviant things, is the group home or is the independent living program actually helping them? Are they instilling something where these young people will reflect? Now, I'm not blaming anyone. I'm just saying that a lot of programs need to be more structured in how they implement what they're supposed to, because it worked. Consistency works. I'm going to give you one last example. Dunbar Middle School. In 1 year, we had an 85% success rate with school-based mentoring because we had caring adults who were consistent in the philosophy that we're going to help this young person be responsible. We had expectations, and so what we created was an artificial environment that the young people had to assimilate into, and so when they finished with their environment, they was able to go out and be better in society, and we have the outcome evaluation based on that.
Let me open the phones here again. This is 410, a number of people calling in at 410-319-8888. After looking at what happens with young people who are homeless, who end up in group homes, and are we really doing the work we need to do to make these young people productive members of our society? And Theodora, in Baltimore County, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling. I'm a Baltimore City school teacher.
Welcome.
I had the pleasure of allowing Mr. Dante to use my classroom at Diggs Johnson Middle School for a brief time. And my concern was that the school was not able and not very willing to accommodate Mr. Dante when the young men that he was working with were certainly showing enthusiasm and excitement. Some of them knew him before he even came into the school. So, and one point that the caller and most of the speakers have brought up is relationships,
yes, ma'am,
and more importantly, consistency. On the middle school level, I'm finding that most of the adults in their lives are inconsistent. The young people don't trust them. They say one thing and do another thing. It's important that we are consistent with our young people, certainly our young men, because they see mother figures everywhere they go, in the classroom,
right,
in the workplace, everywhere they go. And they're getting different messages, and they're trying to respond to all of this confusion that we're placing in their lives. That's my comment. The other thing is I'd like to get Mr. Dante's information, because as a teacher, I'm sure they're always in need of mentors and just people who are on board with their vision.
Well, what we'll do is
our young people. So if he would give his information, I'll just hang up and listen to everybody's comments.
But relationships and
consistency is two of the most important things, certainly that our young men, and I'm saying it not only as a teacher but also as a mom of two young men who have grown up to be fine young men.
All right, Theodore, if you'll hold on, we'll get your number. We'll give it to Dante when he gets off the air.
Okay.
So he can get that, get in touch with you, unless he wants to give his information over the air.
Oh, I can.
All right.
My number is 443-226-6866.
And we'll put that on our website as well. Let's go to Diane in Southeast. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mark.
Hi.
Good afternoon to
good
you
afternoon.
Guys.
Good afternoon.
I had to call. At first, I wasn't going to call. But, Dante, you said it right. You know, it's just not with the group homes. It's even when the men come out of the young men that come out of jail, because they went in as youth and they come out like in their 20s and stuff like that.
Yes, ma'am.
What they call transitional housing or halfway houses. It's the same thing. They're not prepared when they come out here on the street. The majority of them are homeless.
Mm.
And, it's, you know, the state, it's a shame because the state doesn't make sure they have a permanent address, and then we wonder why we have all this conflict in our neighborhoods with the violence and stuff because of that, you know. And, you know, and you talked about it, and it's good. And I want to know, do each one of these young people have a caseworker when they're in the group home, an individual caseworker?
Dante?
They have a caseworker when they in the group home, but once they get discharged, they no longer have that caseworker. So, and then even because some caseworkers still want to maintain a relationship, but if you're homeless, you don't have a phone number where they can reach you on a consistent basis. Because the young man that I spoke to, he said, I left a message for my worker, but I don't have a phone number in which she can get back in contact with me, so he don't know if a connection was trying to be made, and that's when we made the connection with Cold Blue with the shelter downtown.
Diane, thank you for your call so much. Let's try to get a quick call from Denise for Dante. Denise, you're on the air.
Hello. Hello.
Hi, Denise. Go ahead.
Yes, I just want to piggyback on what everyone was saying. I think that what I noticed as a professional clinical social worker in Baltimore City is that there is just an extreme lack of parenting, and we understand that, and we know that. And it's not, I mean, we could try to teach parenting classes and all of this to reel parents back in. But, however, for the 16-year-old and the 14-year-old, you know, parenting for their parent may not work. So these kids are in group homes and other places and in foster homes. They need to have workers who are invested in what I consider to be a deprogramming, if you will.
We're almost out of time, Denise. I want to give Dante a chance to kind of wrap up with what you were saying and where he thinks we should go next. And Dante will be back within the next few weeks to do this again for an entire hour.
Okay. I totally agree that I think that many parents are fed up and they feel inadequate, especially when it comes to having teenage boys, and our boys grow so big and they so in tune to the culture or the subculture that parents a lot of time become afraid. And so when these young people are in these, I'm going to call them institutions, group homes and independent living, where the state is paying the provider $5,000 per month per participant that's in a program, that program has the power to shape the climate and culture and help be consistent with the prevention and intervention skills that a young person need. Because the reality is, especially with 14, 15, 16s and up, they're not transitioning back home to mama. They're going to transition into the community as an independent living person. So have we prepared them how to communicate? Which group homes, if we're talking about solutions, group homes need to prepare them how to communicate, how to interview for a job correctly, how to wear something correctly, suit and tie. We're not talking about khakis and Oxford shirts anymore with Timberland boots, but how to go back to how you really supposed to present yourself at a job interview, how to teach people with daily living skills, because, oh my goodness, $8 an hour cannot apartments. One bedroom is like $800 a month now, you know?
Right.
So we really have to teach independent living skills from the onset of a child coming into our program. But too often we have staff that are burnt out. They work in multiple hours and different things at the group homes. All of them, in my humble opinion, aren't trained properly. But there's a lot of interventions that could be put in place, and then we would have a lower recidivism rate of homeless teenage youth and young adults.
Dante Wilson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Mark.
Dante will be back, and he'll be back a lot to talk about young people in our communities and what we can do in a better way. Maybe team some of these folks up with the folks who are actually in power. Maybe they'll listen to what Dante Wilson has to say. Charisse Lanier, it was a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for being in our studio.
You as well, Mark. Thanks
honored
for
to have
me.
You here. Same to you, Michael Blackwell. Thank you so
thank
much.
You.
We're going to take a very brief break. I want to say on our way to break, Mark Steiner's show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com or log on to steinershow.org and click on their banner. The information is there as well. We'll be right back to look at social media, its power and danger in our society, then look what's going on in Madison, Wisconsin, where the workers are fighting, maybe not just for themselves, but for the rest of this nation. Stay with us.